Thanks for joining me. I'm Frank Sesno. I'm host of Planet Forward, online and on as seen on PBS, and I'm director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. It is my great pleasure to be sitting in for Diane Rehm today. Diane is recuperating, and today we have a very interesting conversation this hour. For nearly 50 years, Jane Goodall has been studying and protecting wildlife the world over, with a special emphasis on chimpanzees. She is a world-renowned conservationist and founder of the Jane Goodall Institute, a global nonprofit to help people improve the environment and all living things. And now, at a time when many people are worried about the fate of the planet, she is optimistic. And in a new book titled Hope for Animals and Their World, she tells survival stories about how endangered species are being rescued from the brink of extinction. As part of our series on the environment, Jane Goodall joins me now in the studio. And it's so good to see you.
It's good to see you, too.
I feel like you are a part of our lives in so many ways. And I was asking you before we went on the air, what number book is this for you? And you said?
I said I couldn't remember.
You've lost count.
Well, I've done many for children. And anyway, I would have to count. So.
Well, what I was struck by in this book, right off the bat, right out of the foreword, the very first words were, a book of hopeful stories about wildlife. That's not the type of book you hear about very often, hopeful stories.
This is exactly why I felt it was so desperately important to write this book. And, you know, there's the media, everywhere you go, everyone's full of doom and gloom, and rightly so. We have made one terrible mess of the environment, society, and everything else on the planet. But at the same time, my crazy schedule that takes me traveling 300 days a year enables me to meet some extraordinary people who are tackling projects which everybody laughs at and says, well, you can't succeed, it's no good, and they won't give up. And because of their stubbornness and passion, they have managed to actually save creatures that were on the very, very brink of extinction.
Did I just hear you say you travel 300 days a year?
You did.
And you see all kinds of people and all kinds of places and all kinds of animals.
That's exactly right.
So, just pulling from the table of contents in the book, the black-footed ferret, California condor, red wolf, American crocodile, these animals and many more in here all have something in common.
They have the fact that they were on the very, very brink of extinction. I think all the ones you read out were saved by captive breeding, I believe.
Yes.
And then reintroduced back into the wild.
And what inspired you to write this book, and why now?
I think that the little germ of the book started when I met an amazing person called Don Merton in New Zealand. And he told me how he had saved a little black robin, it's a cute little bird, from almost certain extinction. Everybody laughed at him. You know, at one time there were just 7 birds left, of which only 2 were female, of whom only one of those 2 was fertile. And there's now over 200 of those robins. Nobody believed he could do it. And he did it by clever manipulation of the nests and the babies and the stories all in the book. And then, so I started taking with me what I call symbols of hope. And I heard about the California condor, and they gave me one of these amazing wing feathers.
Mm-hmm. Which you do what with? You carry that with you?
I carry it in a tube, and I can slowly pull it out. And people go, ah, because it's so long. And that bird was reduced to just 12 individuals.
12?
12.
And now?
And now there's slightly over 300, of which slightly over half are back in the wild.
How was that done?
It was done by catching the last of the wild ones and captive breeding. And again, you know, people felt that very strongly. There was a big controversy, and a lot of people felt it was better to let the birds die with dignity in the wild. But this small group of biologists who were told, you won't succeed, they won't breed in captivity, you'll probably kill them when you catch them, give it up, let them die, but they wouldn't. And now this extraordinary bird, this master of the skies with this huge wingspan, is flying free in 4 states.
Why would people have argued, let them die with dignity?
Feeling that they're so marvelous in flight that it would be cruel to capture them and enclose them.
Were they right?
No, I think not. In fact, some of those original ones who were caught have been released again. So they've bred, and now they're back where they started.
Of all the animals and these sort of back-from-the-brink stories that you write about in Hope for Animals in Their World, is there one that just strikes you as the most remarkable story, the most incredible sort of at the 11th hour save?
Well, I think the black robin that I mentioned, that has to be, I mean, it was Adam and Eve. It was just one male and one female, and the female did something that female black robins don't do. She left her old-time mate, who turned out to be sterile, picked a younger guy, and the two of them saved their species. There's a plaque in their honor at the Chatham Island Airport.
You write in your book, too, about the, let me see if I've got this right, the American burying beetle.
But, you know, Lou Perotti, who's worked on that, you know about these beetles? People are amazed by this.
What's
story.
The American burying beetle? Well, I've never even heard of one.
It's a beetle about 2 inches long, rather beautiful. And they work in pairs. They find a dead animal. They work very hard to bury it.
To bury it?
To bury it. And they completely bury it. They help to, you know, keep the land pure. Then they make themselves a little chamber. They mate. The female lays her eggs on the dead carcass. And then they wait in the chamber until the babies hatch. And the baby's jaws aren't strong enough to start eating at this dead meat. So the parents go and chew up the meat and feed the babies. And there's a lovely little addition to the story that the parents carry on their backs little tiny orange mites. And when the dead animal is buried, usually flies have managed to lay some eggs. These little mites, their job is to jump off the parents, hop onto the food that's for the babies, eat up the fly maggots that have hatched or the eggs, and then when the parents leave, because the young are old enough to feed themselves, the little mites hop back on board and they go off to start over again. Now, this is incredible. And, you know, Lou, I met him just last week in New York. We had a little party to celebrate the book. And he said, a lady came up to him and she said, your beetles do a better job of raising their young than my children have done of raising my. And she gave him $75,000. Oh. Yes.
But you speak about these bugs like they're, you know, a little family. They're bugs.
They're bugs, but they are. You see, that's the magic of this book. It's meeting the people, not just those who are saving the charismatic giant pandas and so forth, but the little bugs and the crocodiles. And also, of course, the people who are working to restore habitats.
I will ask you a question, but ask you not to leap across and slap me around for asking. Because some might. What difference does it make whether bugs like this are around or not?
You know, the fascinating thing here is that in spite of all our research and all that people have learned about the natural world, it's still not clear the role that each species plays in an ecosystem. But there are examples where one small, seemingly insignificant little bug or little plant, let's say, disappears. And that was the one food of a certain little insect. And that insect was the only food of a certain little fish, for example. And it has led to collapses of ecosystems, just moving one piece of the puzzle.
Jane Goodall, I also understand there's this black-footed ferret and this little paw print cast that you travel around with. What's that all about?
Well, the black-footed ferret is the cutest, sweetest little tiny ferret, and it lives on the Great Prairies. It lives in the burrows of prairie dogs. And that being also was almost extinct. It was down to about, I think it was 17. And again, they thought they were extinct many times. Then they would find another little population. And finally, this last population was crashing. And the biologists got permission to catch the last ones and do captive breeding. Now they're back in many states. But here the big problem is that people will poison prairie dogs. The ranchers don't like the holes. They say the cattle will break their legs, although there actually isn't an example of a cattle or a horse with a broken leg. But, you know, until the prairies can be made safe, this tremendous work in the long run will be to no avail.
Another wonderful story that you write about, and it is a remarkable animal, is the whooping crane.
The whooping crane. It's a beautiful, beautiful bird. Very tall, very stately. The tallest bird in North America.
Tallest bird in North America.
Yes.
I didn't realize that.
Yes. And at one time, there was just one flock, and it migrates. They migrate 2,000 miles, slightly more, from Texas to Canada. But it was reduced to 27 birds. So if something like bird flu had hit those 27 birds, that would be the end. So they wanted to set up another migratory flock. And to do that, how would they teach them a completely new migration route they learned from their parents? And so they taught them to follow an ultralight. And I went to visit Joe Duff of Operation Migration. And it was just magic. He took me up in the ultralight. And these beautiful birds following, they still had their golden cinnamon feathers. They weren't yet pure white.
And you wrote at one point about this very almost emotional experience where you had these eggs and chicks and they had to be transported and you had just a fraction of what you started out with. What happened?
With the whooping crane?
Yes.
Well, the story, you know, it's such a long and involves so many people.
But basically it was...
But basically they had to collect eggs from the wild nest. Once they discovered where they were breeding, and that took forever, they were hidden away. And then Ernie Coit would go and collect one egg from a nest and take it back for captive breeding. And then they had to really work out ways of incubating these eggs.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Jane Goodall and saving the animals around the planet. And welcome back. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. And our guest is Jane Goodall. We are talking about specifically her new book, Hope for Animals and Their World, How Endangered Species Are Being Rescued from the Brink. But you can't have a conversation with Jane Goodall without talking about Jane Goodall and all these many, many other things that she has done in her life. And earlier, I was asking you about the books that you had written, and you were talking about some of the children's books, and you have a reissue that's coming out this year.
Well, we have a reissue of several of the books, actually, because next year is the 50th anniversary of the chimpanzee research at Gombe.
50th anniversary.
50th anniversary.
And you haven't even turned 40 yet.
I wish.
So which of the children's books?
The children's book that we're... still haven't completely finalized it, but the book I wrote about my son, Grub the Bush Baby. But the one I'm really excited about is the first book I ever did on the chimpanzees, In the Shadow of Man, which is still selling about as well every year as it always has.
And this is a children's book?
No, this isn't.
Oh, this is the In the Shadow of Man, the chimpanzee book. But of the children's books you've written, do you find that people still talk to you about them, people still relate to them, or that you find that they come back to you with stories having read them in their childhood years ago?
Yes, all the books. I mean, people again and again say, again, especially with The Shadow of Man, that they read it when they were 12 and it changed the way they thought about animals, or it changed their life. It made them decide to be a wildlife biologist, veterinarian, or something like that. And I was gathering up some of these comments for my new introduction, and it was really amazing, actually, to see what the influence that one book.
Is there somebody who's renowned or a prize winner someplace who has come to you and said such a thing you feel special kinship with?
Well, actually, most of the people that I was able to talk to about this new book have told me that they were influenced by reading my work when they were young.
Back to your current work, and another of these endangered species you write about, and this is very interesting to think about, and it's gray wolves. Now, hunting of the gray wolves began just last week in Idaho. Is this, in your view, a symbol of success because they have repopulated, or a step backward?
It's definitely a step backwards. Really, they haven't. I mean, there aren't that many gray wolves. It was Thane Maynard, my co-author, who wrote about the gray wolves, but I've seen them in Yellowstone. And I think to allow people to go and kill them just as they're beginning to make a comeback. And, you know, they have this elaborate social structure. So people are shooting maybe the lead wolf in a pack, and it'll take an awful long time for them to recover.
How can you be optimistic in a book like this and in your stories when, as by your own admission, you say that we're sort of surrounded by stories of loss and endangerment? I spent some time up in New Hampshire this year up on beautiful lake, Squam Lake, where On Golden Pond was shot. And if anybody has seen that movie, they remember that wonderful scene with Katharine Hepburn saying to Henry Fonda, "The loons, Norman, the loons." They have that distinctive call. Last year, there were virtually no loons. I heard almost no calls. This year, we were told very proudly that there are 5 loons back and 2 chicks. So endangered. But you're the optimist.
Well, there are more loons in other places, so they're just endangered there. So theoretically, you could.
Well, I just cite that as an example of the kind of thing.
I know, but I do know. I mean, I know that's. But you know, this is it's so important right now to let people realize that all is not lost if we take action now, and this is why I'm working so very hard to grow our youth program, because, you know, people say, well, why aren't you worrying only about chimpanzees? Why are you working with youth? But it doesn't matter what animal we're trying to save. If we're not raising new generations to do a better job at caring for the planet than we've done, then we may as well give up. So it's just really, really important. And young people work on their parents and their grandparents. And it's quite extraordinary how this Roots and Shoots program has spread around the world. There's about 10,000 active groups, and it's all ages, preschool all the way through university, with more and more groups among adults.
And what is it?
It's the most important message is that each one of us makes a difference every single day. And even if we only make small changes in behavior, that cumulatively can result in very major change. So Roots and Shoots, it's symbolic. Imagine a little seed. It's going to be a big tree. It starts to grow, tiny little roots, a tiny little shoot. So much life force in that seed that those roots can work through boulders to reach the water and eventually push them aside. And that little shoot can work through cracks in a brick wall to reach the sunlight and eventually knock the wall down. So if we see the boulders and the walls as all the bad things we have inflicted on this planet, environmental and social, then it's hope. Hundreds and thousands of young people around the world can get together and break through and make this a better world.
Well, we're going to invite our listeners to join us on the phone. Some have already done that. They can do that at 1-800-433-8850 if you're listening. But we've already got some emails. Those are addressed to drshow@wamu.org. Here's one from Keith in Indianapolis. A huge cause of extinction is habitat loss, he writes, by development and human exploitation of natural resources. So how can endangered species be reintroduced to their natural environment after that environment has been completely lost, has lost its habitat, migratory routes, and mating grounds?
Well, we've already talked about this, that this is the most important problem that has to be tackled. And I think one part of the book, which is actually given in much greater detail on our website, we couldn't fit everything into the book, it was just too much. But talking about restoring completely destroyed ecosystems. And if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I'd be pretty amazed. You talked about the loon. The first place I heard a loon was in Sudbury and in Canada. Sudbury was at one time totally It was black rock. It was completely destroyed by nickel mining. And the people got together and decided that this was not appropriate. And after like over 100 years, there are two pictures in the book that show before and after what a group of determined people who won't give up can actually do. And all kind of animals have come back onto that once totally dead landscape.
Do we need to make commitments to large new swaths of conserved land?
We need to do everything we can. And you know, there are these conservation easements where people are given tax breaks and things like that not to cultivate. And there are safe harbors where people agree to save the land because there's an endangered species on it, but they won't be penalized. And then, of course, there's the Endangered Species Act itself. So if you find an endangered species, you can't destroy the
land.
Let's
talk about habitat for a minute, another particular animal. A large part of the panda's habitat was destroyed in last year's earthquake. So what's the status of the panda? Everybody loves the panda, and we hope not just in zoos, but the natural habitat is very precarious for the panda.
Yeah, we're still trying to find out how many pandas were killed. It's difficult because nobody knows quite how many there were. But a big breakthrough was made in the breeding of the panda, so there are more pandas. Now the next step is to find ways to reintroduce them. And the extent of the damage to the wild panda's habitat, I'm still not sure. We're still trying to find out. But according to George Shallow, who spent 4 years out there studying the pandas, and some of the Chinese experts, the hope for the giant panda is greater now, its conservation, than at any time in the last 40, 50 years.
What do we know about breeding pandas in captivity, which itself is such a difficult thing to do, and then reintroducing them into the wild habitat?
Well, the problem with the breeding was that the Chinese scientists were very passionate about artificial insemination. And they were keeping the pandas alone. They were afraid that the male would attack the female. And Deborah Kleiman, who's also in the book, she saved the golden lion tamarin, but she went out there and introduced some different husbandry so that the pandas could be together and, most importantly, had trees to climb and things to do and could behave more like real pandas. And so mating started to happen naturally. So a young one raised by its parents has more chance of being reintroduced into the wild. It hasn't happened yet.
Jane Goodall, we're talking from Washington, D.C. here, and one of the big attractions at the National Zoo here in Washington is the panda. What do you think when you think of pandas in zoos?
Well, I think it's very sad. On the other hand, if they weren't in zoos, nobody probably would have known or cared about them. But, you know, most zoos until very recently didn't know how to exhibit a panda, even if they had the money. They didn't realize they spent a lot of time up trees. People are beginning to understand now that animals need better kinds of habitat, particularly if you want to reintroduce them back into the wild.
Are there new species that we still haven't discovered, don't know about?
Yeah, that's what's so amazing. I mean, some of these expeditions, like to the Foja Mountains in New Guinea, I was talking to Bruce Beeler, who's with the Conservation International, the Nature Conservancy, and the expedition that they've been on three now, all kinds of completely new birds, new insects, new frogs, new plants. And then just in Tanzania, two new species of monkeys discovered.
What are they?
It's the Kipunji. It's known as the Kipunji. And it was discovered, I say, two new species, the same species, miles apart, the same year by two different expeditions, finding the same monkey. I mean, what are the odds of that happening?
Have you seen it? I
haven't seen the actual. I've seen photograph only.
And what distinguishes this newly discovered species of monkey?
It's a new genus. And it makes, instead of making, oh, I can't remember what they describe, it's a click, wobble, woo, woo. You've got it written there. I can't remember. It makes a funny sound. Uh-huh. It's a gobbling sound.
I understand you're pretty good at doing the sound of your chimpanzees.
I can do the chimpanzees sound.
Go ahead.
Well, it's a bit loud for whoever's recording this.
I'll duck.
It's the greeting, so it's to everybody who's listening.
Okay.
It's great.
Go ahead.
For that.
Go ahead. Should I tell them to turn their volume down first?
Probably. And it carries across valley, and every individual has his or her own particular voice.
Now, if you do that surrounded by chimpanzees, what do they think of you?
I wouldn't do it, because we try not to intervene, but we do it to captive chimps. And we use, you know, the thing is, they have so many postures and gestures that are identical to ours, so we communicate with captive chimps with gestures that we use when we communicate with each other.
Do you have, in all the work that you've done over the years with chimpanzees, now with this conservation work, is there a high point for you, a day, a discovery, a moment that just stands out above all others?
I think the one that I can never forget is the first chimpanzee to lose his fear of me was David Greybeard. And he actually was allowing me to follow. This is in very early 1961. And I followed him through a dense patch of vegetation, thinking I'd lost him, found him sitting as though waiting for me, sat near him, saw a palm nut lying on the ground. They loved them, so I picked it up in the palm of my hand and held it out to him. He turned his face away. I held my hand closer. He looked directly in my eyes, reached out, took the nut, dropped it, and then very gently held my fingers, which is how chimpanzees reassure each other. So that was a perfect communication in which we each understood the other, probably based on the same kind of language that our earliest ancestors used before the development of human language.
And there you were. What went through your mind?
It was just such an amazing moment. I treasured it.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us in talking with Jane Goodall, please call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. We will get to your calls in just a couple of minutes. What's next for Jane Goodall?
Continuing to grow the youth program, publishing some of the material that couldn't be published in this book, but as I say, is on the website. The next one is going to be The Kingdom of the Plants, giving credit to the amazing botanists, horticulturists, wildlife people who, you know, they risk their lives to hand-fertilize plants on some rocky ledge out of the reach of introduced goats and so forth, and then learn to propagate a seed that won't grow. And they're amazing people.
Let's go to the amazing people who are joining us today and listening to this program and want to speak with you. And we'll start with Mark, who's calling us from Bedford, Texas. Go ahead, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. First, a big, huge appreciation for Ms. Goodall's work around the world. She has truly spread the word about animals, and we really appreciate it. So thank you much for having her as a guest.
Thank you.
And secondly, I wanted to know if there's anything that we can do individually that you might touch on to help all these animals. You mentioned the non-charismatic animals, and specifically I'm thinking of all the farm animals and such. And as a vegan, I'm saving about 70 to 100 animals a year, and I'm wondering if you could touch on that as well.
The topic you raise is very, very important, because we've already said several times that the environment is key. And it turns out, which most people don't really realize, that because of the intensive farming of animals, because of the growing appetite for meat in countries like China, that vast areas of the natural world are being turned into agriculture to grow the grain or grazing for cattle. And so that in itself is damaging. But what's even worse, given that climate change, global warming is one of the key problems that we face today, is that this intensive farming leads to vast production of methane gas, and that is contributing more to greenhouse gases than the fossil fuel of all the cars around the world.
So you think people should change their eating habits?
Definitely. I mean, none of us need to eat a lot of meat. I don't eat any, not fish or chicken. Some people feel they must, but nobody needs to eat large amounts of meat every day. And it would make such a difference if people would just stop eating so much meat. And, you know, we've got a new film coming out, Jane's Journey, for cinema next year. And one of the scenes is on a sanctuary for farm animals in Austria, where these 10 sows have been rescued their truck fell over. Some of them were killed. They have been genetically modified so that they get two extra ribs so we can get more pork chops and huge amounts of muscle on their thighs for bigger hams. They can hardly walk. But out in a field, they were blissfully happy, rootling with their strong snouts. A magic scene.
Here's an email for you. Please ask Jane to address what's going on with the clouds herd in the Pryor Mountains.
With the?
Clouds herd in the Pryor Mountains.
I don't know about the clouds herd in the... Sorry.
Okay, we'll come back to that one. Well, we'll also take a break, and we'll come back to you, Jane Goodall, and more questions and our phone calls here on the Diane Rehm Show, so stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org. And by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we're joined by the NBA's most valuable player and the highest paid athlete in the league, LeBron James. His new book, Shooting Stars, is about his early years in basketball, in junior high and high school. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. My guest is Jane Goodall. We're talking about any number of things in her exceptional career and reach and interest, but in particular her new book, Hope for Animals and Their World, How Endangered Species Are Being Rescued from the Brink. We have lots of phone callers for you, Jane Goodall, so let me go back to the phones and bring up DJ, who's calling us from Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, DJ.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, you bet.
Jane, it's an honor to be able to speak with you today. You're one of our family's heroes. The question I had was with regard to the California condor and the black robin. Can you address the concern that I have and I think others may have with interbreeding? As far as I think you said, black robin came back from just two, and it seems like if that species were to go forward, there would be some interbreeding with the associated problems.
Yeah, well, this is why they have divided the 200 or so black robins into four different communities on four different islands, with the hope that there will be some genetic drift. The cheetah, of course, also came through this bottleneck, and the cheetahs that we have today all came from almost identical genetic stock. So I don't think the geneticists yet know enough to predict how these will go. The California condor, there were 12, and they all had a different genetic mix to start with. So it's a lot better than just the two of the black robins.
Now to Juan, who joins us from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Juan.
Hi, this is a great honor. I cannot believe in my life I could talk to somebody who has been in my heart for all these years. And what I want to say is that I travel throughout the nation on the national forests whenever I have time, and I cannot believe my eyes as to how much destruction people that visit the parks do. They treat our parks like a dump, and I don't see the government doing anything to educate the public as to how urgent or how important it is for us to maintain the parks in a way that will prevent damage to the ecological system. And I got two kids that I enjoy taking all the time, my two daughter and son, to the parks and try to teach some of my knowledge about the environment. And I'd like to know what more can we do as far as educating our youth to do more for endangered species and plants, which I do on my own, but there seem to be a tremendous amount of work that people can do, and we are not doing one good job on it.
Thanks, Juan, for your question. Jane?
Yes. Well, it's lovely talking to you as well. And, of course, the answer, as far as I'm concerned, is, as you say, it's lack of education. And that's why I'm working so very hard to develop this Roots and Shoots program. And I would suggest that you check out the website or write to us or whatever you would like about the Roots and Shoots program.
What's the website?
Rootsandshoots.org.
Easy enough.
Easy enough. But you can do janegoodall.org and find out all of it. And get your children involved in this program. Get the program into their school. And then you're educating your children because you care. But a lot of children then can turn around and educate their parents who perhaps don't care. And I see it happening all the time. You know, don't throw the trash there. It's going to hurt this creature. Don't do that. It's happening. So we have to develop more and more young people who care.
And we have links on our show. If you go to drshow.org, you'll hear and learn more about Jane Goodall and Roots and Shoots, and that's another way to get at that. Here's our next caller who's calling from Copenhagen. Eddie is on the phone. Is it Eddie or Edie?
Edie.
Edie. Well, welcome, Edie, from Copenhagen, and your question for Jane Goodall. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about the fact that I see a big disconnect in the way that Americans think about animals and the environment and the way Europeans, or at least Danes, think about animals and the environment. They're so conscious of animal rights and treating the environment right over here. And I just wanted to ask you if you have any idea why the big disconnect.
Thanks, Edie, for your question. Jane?
I don't think it's that big a disconnect. There's a tremendous amount of concern and understanding of animal rights and the environment over in the United States as well. I think the country got a pretty bad rap environmentally during the years of the last administration, which really was not friendly towards the environment and didn't encourage these kind of ideas very much. But there are a lot of animal rights groups over in the U.S. There's a lot of environmental groups. Our Roots and Shoots program is in every state. And, you know, so there is a lot of concern.
So how would you I mean, let me put you on the spot here a little bit. Mm-hmm. How would you rate Americans and the United States in terms of its position on these issues that you care about?
Well, there's Americans and Americans. There seems to be a political divide here. And so it would depend who I was talking to, and I'm not going to get involved in politics here, but there is definitely a difference.
That's very diplomatic of you.
And it depends in which part of the country you are. But I'll tell you one thing, that it doesn't matter where I've been in the so-called red states and, you know, tough conservative types, but when I give a talk where I'm talking about issues and not politics, I haven't had any opposition. I have had staunch conservatives standing up applauding when their own children said, "I'm so amazed that Dad listen to you and likes what you say. So it depends how we address these things. And to go around being holier than thou and pointing fingers and saying you people are bad, that is not the way.
You think that's one of those? There are some within the environmental movement who criticize others within the movement for doing just that, for preaching doom and gloom, for preaching to people, pointing fingers.
Yeah.
Is that a problem within the environmental and conservation movement, do you think?
It's a very big problem. I mean,
and so your advice to them?
The advice is, you know, you've got to find a way to get into somebody's heart. And just shouting at them and telling them they're doing bad things and blinding them with numbers and statistics, you will never get anyone to change.
To our next caller, Timothy calls us with a variation on this theme, I think, from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Timothy.
Hello, how are you? Miss Goodall, such a pleasure. And keep up the good work. My question is, the lady Sigourney Weaver played in the movie that protected or tried to study the gorillas. She was killed. Have you ever faced such danger? And what is that lady's name? Did you know her?
Diane Fossey. Yes, I knew her very well. And nobody's actually sure how she was killed, but we think that she was killed by poachers. And the difference in her, the way that she tackled her problems and the way that we've tackled ours at Gombe, is that we've employed the local people. She employed some of the people, but she didn't try and reach out to the poachers, who really, to start with, were poaching gorillas because they wanted money. And, you know, I was always trying to persuade her to take some of them, train them to be field staff. She wouldn't let any of them see the gorillas because she said then they'd be more vulnerable to poachers. But the chimps know the difference between our staff and outsiders, and I'm sure the gorillas would as well.
Question here from James, who writes in via email to drshow@wamu.org. Here we go. You were quoted on an NPR show a few years ago noting that you either believed that Bigfoot-type creatures could exist in certain areas in the United States and around the world, or that you would not be surprised to find that they existed. Could you explain further about this issue? Bigfoot.
Bigfoot.
I didn't see a chapter on Bigfoot in your book.
No, I didn't write about Bigfoot in the book. But I'm asked questions about my belief in Bigfoot all the time, or Sasquatch, or the Yowie of Australia, or the abominable snowman, the Yeti, different names all over the place. I cannot believe that the descriptions of these creatures around the world would be so similar if there wasn't something. My scientific mind says, well, it's very strange there aren't any remains if these creatures exist. But on the other hand, logic says, well, it's all over the place. And my best story comes from Ecuador, from the middle of nowhere. And I was there with some villagers. We actually introducing roots and shoots in the middle of nowhere. It took 2 hours of flying with no roads. And the little communities maintained contact because the hunters would go like the old traveling troubadours and they would take the news. And so I asked the interpreter, I said, will you ask some of these hunters to ask in the villages? All I said was, have you seen a monkey walking upright? No more than that. And much later, I got the answer that in three of the little villages, people said, oh, yes. There's a monkey. It walks upright. It has no tail. It's about 7 foot high.
Okay. And from that, you conclude?
Well, from that, I conclude that, you know, these people had no vested interest. There was no, oh, she wants to hear that there's a Bigfoot.
But what happens to your scientific mind? Like you say, you know, if there was something that huge and had been around for a while, wouldn't someone find a remain or a bone or something?
Not if they are of an advanced enough level that they actually understand and can bury their dead. You don't actually find, talking to hunters, you don't find like dead bears around very often. You don't find dead mountain lions, and they're pretty big.
So you're a believer, agnostic, where are you?
I have an open mind, I'm a romantic, I want them to be there. I'm not going to say they're not there. Absolutely, I think they might be.
Wow. Okay. Arlene from Potomac, Maryland joins us. Hi, Arlene.
Hi. Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
We sure can. Go ahead with your question.
Listen, it's an honor to speak to you, Jane. And I'm wondering, in a way, if you could help guide me to something I could read. And I'll tell you that I have and continue to work with kids, and I love animals, and I think they come out, I'm a teacher, really having a positive attitude. But in my heart, these gloom and doom numbers that, and I've been reading for so long. I used to have to go into the NIH to read. Now I can read anywhere. But I, you know, the things that I know now globally, I mean, I know that only that 80% of all our animals are living on only 6% of our planet that's left. And I know what's going on with the oceans and the acidification, and that I've been down scuba diving and I've seen the coral reefs dying, and I've been to the Amazon, and I know that within, they say at this rate, within about 30 years it's going to be gone.
So Arlene, my
question is you have such a positive attitude, and I'm having a hard time keeping my head up and moving forward. Because I'm not sure, what things are going to look like. Is there something that you could recommend to read, or advice that you could give me to be more, what I think is realistic, but maybe you have a different take on it?
Thanks, Arlene. It can be a little overwhelming out there, and Arlene is certainly, I think, tapping into that. Statistics, the numbers are bleak.
They're very, very bleak. The point is that science is often proved wrong as to its predictions in the future. There's a very interesting discussion going on about global warming with the people who say, well, it's nothing to do with humans, on the one hand saying, that it's a cycle. And on the other hand, the people who firmly believe that the climate change is due to us, which I believe. And I was just in Greenland watching the ice melt, seeing the Inuits cry. But we don't yet know how fast the ice is melting. We don't yet know that it's going to be true about the Amazon. We don't yet know what might happen to reduce human numbers suddenly with a huge plague like thing. We just can't predict the future. So we have to cling to everything we can and do the best we can and give our children hope so that they go on fighting like the people in this book. And honestly, why don't you read this book and see if this gives you any little glimmering of something to cling on to like it did me?
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're talking with Jane Goodall, who is author of Hope for Animals and Their World, How Endangered Species Are Being Rescued from the Brink. I want to point one thing out, because one of our intrepid producers went out to check that email that we got from the listener a few moments ago who wanted to know about Cloud's Prior Mountain herd. Well, it's one of the country's last herds of wild mustangs, led by a stallion called Cloud. And a public television documentary was made a few years back by a woman who observed this herd and continues to observe it. She's had a follow-up now that Cloud, who just had a foal in the first documentary, is the lead stallion of the herd. So, now you know, wild mustangs. Jane Goodall, you talked a little while ago about what's next for you, which is to continue to push on this thing. And you mentioned to me when we were in a break that you are headed for Copenhagen for this climate change conference, this big thing that's going to try to determine what's next after the failed Kyoto Protocol. What are you going to do in Copenhagen? What do you want from governments around the world?
Well, I'm not totally sure exactly what I'm going to be doing, to be honest, yet. It's an invitation from Google Earth. They're working with one of our scientists, Lilian Pintea, in Brazil, working with some of the Amerindians there. To try and locate the roads that are being built and that sort of thing. I hope to learn a lot from the conference. I hope to learn a lot about carbon trading for avoided deforestation, which I believe is, you mentioned China. Okay, so China goes to Africa, and China is offering money to the government to take the forest concession so they can take the timber. So what can we offer the government that equals the Chinese money? The Chinese money, if we can equal it with money from the current big polluters who pay to pollute. Now, that's not a long-term solution. But for the moment, if we can just use that money to keep the forest intact, and we now have the technology to be able to make a survey and check on whether the government is actually doing what it says it's going to do and not cutting the trees down as well as taking the money.
We have about 15 seconds left. I have a daughter who's studying marine biology in college, and she's very determined. What is your message to her and to the next generation?
The message is that we must never give up. The message is that we and our own individual lives make a difference. And the message is, roll up your sleeves, get out there, join with others who feel like you do, and just don't give up.
Jane Goodall, author of Hope for Animals and Their World, and a legend in your own time. Thank you so much for being with us here today. It's been a pleasure. I'm Frank Sesno. You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.